This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
To the Row One Seat One podcast. This is Ben, aka Boston Nuga. We are a week recovered from the Scenic City Invitational. Thank God, I'm still suffering from one of my fraternity brothers who only went by the name Big Worm, long story, referred to as body weary-itis. He would always just say, "My body weary, I got body weary-itis." I feel you, Big Worm, because I still got that body weary-itis. We're trucking along. I went to TWE this past Saturday night. That's my local indie. I brought Ava. Again, I've stressed this before, but I can't stress it enough. Bring a kid to a local indie show. Not only is it great for your bonding with your kid, but it is great for your socialization for your kid, because your kid will go there and make new friends. And you're supporting a local business and you're supporting local workers. It's great all around. You just support your local indie and bring a kid. No bad can come of it, and you'll feel real good about yourself and feel real good about your relationship with your kid afterwards. Just support your local indie. Support your local indie. And a promoter of one of my local indies is on right now, someone I've been meaning to have on since I started the show, but just been waiting for the right time. I have the promoter of Action Wrestling out of Tyrone, Georgia, Mr. Matthew Griffin. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ben. You are most likely the best person to do a podcast with anything to do related with action, because you've been front row at basically every show. Except the weekend you cheated on me with Michael Blanton and Black Label Pro, but that's okay because I love Mike.
I comprise the heaviest front row in independent wrestling, I think. me and Papa and Zellner and Pete Schermacher, we took a picture with Al Getz. And it looked like the offensive line of the Chicago Bears next to the kicker. we were hefty. We were the hefty boys right there. I love Action Wrestling. I consider it one of my home promotions. It is such a good time. It's a family-friendly show. If any of you guys are in the Atlanta area, we'll talk about Action at the end of the show. But if any of you are in the greater Atlanta area, Action Wrestling, there is not a better time to be had. In the state of Georgia, really, I come from Chattanooga, and I make the anywhere from 2 to 3.5 hour drive, depending on Atlanta traffic, and is well worth my time, because Action Wrestling is just great talent, great people, great atmosphere, and Matt, you really should be commended for what you've been putting on in the last year. We're going on, what, year and a half, 2 years now?
Yeah, our first show was April 27th, 2018, so what, about 16 months now?
Yeah.
We've had great success. We've had great success so far. It has exceeded what I really could have hoped for. All my shows are done as benefits and nonprofit fundraisers. If we sell a ticket to a show, the proceeds, 100%. I don't do any a portion of proceeds. No, all the proceeds from the ticket money and concessions go to a nonprofit or a school.
And that's really what we love. And then the best experience I have had from a heartwarming perspective actually came at an Action Wrestling show, at the Supernova show, and we'll talk about that as well, because that was something that just warmed my heart completely. But one of the other reasons I love you, Matt, is because you are a Massachusetts guy.
Yeah.
And you grew up about, what, an hour from me? You're Western Mass, correct?
I'm out West Row, right outside of Worcester. So not too far down the Mass Pike.
Yeah, not all of us can be exalted like North Shore folks like myself, but we'll allow it. We'll allow it. My
sister lives in Salem now, so I'm going to claim a little bit of North Shoreism.
That's my home. That's my home area, man. That's great. That's great. You can get some Bill and Bob's roast beef there. That's fantastic. what was your first exposure? Were you WSBK Channel 38 Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. just like me?
You know, it's so funny. I started, you know, the first show I ever remember seeing, I'm positive I must have seen something wrestling related earlier, but the first thing I ever remember seeing was the in 89, the main event when the Mega Powers explode. And I remember my dad watching it live. And my dad used to go when he was younger. He used to go to the Boston Garden. And, you know, he told me he would see San Martino and a lot of the other guys. But so I imagine at some point earlier in my life, I had seen some wrestling. But that's the first thing I remember. And then after that, I started seeking out. I'm not Chris Zellner, unfortunately, with with the memorization of the stations. But I remember there were other channels, like maybe 25 or 27. Yep. 27 was out of Worcester and later became a Spanish channel that had ECW on at like 2 a.m. on Friday nights.
Oh, it was Saturday. It was Saturday nights. And I remember that because WAAF, remember the rock station?
Yes, they were in. They were based actually out of Westboro, Mass.
Yes.
I was in there once when they broadcast live.
They used to have their show on at 11, and my buddies and I were metalheads, so we watched the WAAF show, and ECW used to come on after that. So that was our watching block, and it's not like we had dates on Saturday nights, so we would just watch metal and wrestling on Saturday nights.
That's amazing. I started seeking everything out in 89. I remember that Wrestling Spotlight came on at like 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. on one of those stations, which was kind of a compilation show. And since I never saw primetime wrestling, that was helpful. And, you know, Saturdays were Superstars, of course, the A show. And then Challenge was Sundays. But they also had stuff like, and I don't remember the time frames. I'm unfortunately the exact opposite of Chris Zellner. I remember things that happened, but I have no idea of like context of like exactly when or anything like that. But
on the same way,
they used to have. But there was a block of wrestling that had USWA, and I was watching as it was going on, as it was coming out in Massachusetts. I was watching USWA with the Chris Adams, Steve Austin feud, which was absolutely amazing television. I remember taping a bunch of that stuff and wish, of course, that I had kept those VHSs.
I vaguely remember that was like ESPN after school, I think.
It was on because there was a big block. It was, I guess, in my mind, it's similar to
like Sports Channel or something.
In my mind, it's similar to the Pedicino block that Zellner always describes, because ICW was on.
Okay.
With like, was that the Savoldi promotion with like Tony Atlas and those guys?
Yep.
And then there were a few, I think there may have been one or two other shows on at the time as well that I have absolutely no memory of.
Because World Class was apparently on in Boston as well. You're a little older than me. Do you remember World Class being on in Boston?
I have a memory of World Class. I have a memory of watching it at my friend's house. But it may have been because I never had cable growing up. I didn't have cable till 1995, 96. Okay. So it may have been, and that's not a thing I would be really aware of.
Sure.
But, of course, the NWA syndicated shows.
Yeah, the TBS stuff, yeah.
I was able to occasionally, because I stayed with my grandparents every Saturday night, was able to a lot of times watch Saturday night, but the pro and the other NWA, you know, / WCW shows, depending on the time frame, I did get to watch all those. My favorite angle, which I absolutely loved the angle when Woman seduced Rick Steiner. I thought that was such a big deal and so good. You know, and of course, you know, I watched everything I could, but unfortunately my memory is not the best. So exactly when I saw everything and exactly what I saw is so flighty.
See, I was a WF kid, and like I've told this before, but Danvers didn't get pay-per-view. So my dad would take us to my Uncle Tommy's house in Lowell because Lowell got pay-per-views. So we would go there and we'd have man time and we'd drink beer, root beer out of glass bottles and pretend it was beer. And that was like our man time. We were allowed to curse and it was like a whole big thing. But like some towns in Massachusetts had pay-per-views, and this was like, you know, mid to late 80s or whatever. Like, so like I was watching the Macho, you know, the Mega Powers explode at Uncle Tommy's house in Lowell. because North Shore didn't get pay-per-views.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
The first pay-per-view, I mean, I saw some eventually, you know, I was able to go ahead and rent VHS tapes, but the first pay-per-view I remember seeing live was WrestleMania 6. And that was such a big deal to me. And I can remember, like, whenever I hear that classic WrestleMania theme from, like, 6, 7, and 8, you know, the da-na-na, I sometimes I get so, like, fired up because I remember what it was like. I had Smash face paint on. My best friend had Axe, and he had a party over there. It was like a 4 o'clock, maybe, I think it was like a 4 o'clock on a Sunday or something like that. And just being so fired up, like, oh my God, because this event, you know, the pay-per-views were quarterly at this time. The event that you've been waiting for is now, it's starting. And it just being such a cool thing. Holy shit, it's finally here. And then I remember after, I think it's Snuka and Rude, it's like, oh my God, having that realization after they had their like 2.5 minute match that there's no more matches left. Now it's Hogan and Warrior. Oh my God, now it's happening. You know, those are the exciting memories that, you know, you had to hold out and you had to really wait for pay-per-views. And WrestleMania, it's weird because I've always read that WrestleMania was not a big deal to the wrestlers. It was just another stop. It became a thing because all the modern day wrestlers, like, you know, Edge talks about he was in the crowd at mm-hmm. Sky Dome at WrestleMania 6, and you know, other wrestlers, you know, became idolized WrestleMania, and they wanted to make it a big deal. But that to the wrestlers themselves at the time, it was just another stop because they were doing every day on the road.
No, to 7 year old Ben though, WrestleMania was Christmas. Like WrestleMania 6 to me, I was a Warrior guy. And everyone in my class was a Hogan guy, so I walked in that Monday morning like I was king shit when Warrior beat Hogan. Because I cashed in on a 1 in a million ticket, brother.
When it happened, we went over to ran outside at my friend's house and to run around and play or something like that. And I was just remembering thinking like, oh my God, everything is different now.
Yes.
Because even though I hadn't been watching wrestling for at that point that long, Hogan was the only champion going, you know,
that's all we knew
for the year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Macho, yes, I had vague memories that he, you know, I knew he won the belt, but that wasn't when I was watching it. So, but yeah, that's how I started. And, I didn't end up going to my first indie show till 1996. And I can tell you the main event of that show, it was Mike Hollow, who was a Massachusetts guy who became a trainer. Mike Hollow versus Doink the Clown.
Oh, which Doink?
I have no idea, but I'll tell you this. They ran it was Killer Kowalski's group, IWF or something like that. They ran a show like a month later, and I went to it, and I compared autographs from Doinks, and they were absolutely different handwriting. So he had two Doink the Clowns. I would love to know this story. He had two Doink the Clowns that were completely different.
That's amazing. Did you go to any like WF house shows too? Because you vaguely told me a story about a Slaughter thing.
Yes, my very first show. I don't know when they started the advertising for it, but February 89 is when I started watching, and I knew of and was aware of WrestleMania 5, but I didn't see it, so it's like it didn't really happen. You know, I didn't watch it until much later on VHS. But July 89, I went to the Centrum. That was my very first house show. My dad brought me. I still got the ticket stub. I'm literally looking at it right now.
Awesome.
Centrum in Worcester, WWF presents Superstars of Wrestling. Well, it was a Superstars of Wrestling / Saturday Night's Main Event taping.
Oh, that's sick.
So this, it says July 18th. I don't know when the air date would be exactly, but this was the Saturday Night's Main Event when the Brainbusters beat Demolition two out of three falls.
Yeah.
Yeah, to win the belts. And the main event was Hogan and Honky Tonk Man.
That's amazing.
That was my first wrestling show. Can you imagine?
What a start.
And they were doing the marathons then. They were doing the marathon taping. So not only are they taping Saturday Night's Main Event, they're taping 3 or 4 hours of TV. So they were just constantly running guys down.
You know? And your father's probably looking at his watch going, when the hell are we going to get out of here?
You know, he bought me a Hulk Rules shirt, which later in 1990, I got Hogan to autograph when he did a signing at World Gym somewhere in like around the Boston area, like Somerville or something like that. Yes, it's a Saturday Night's Main Event that aired July 29th. And yeah, that's why I fell in love with wrestling, and I decided that I wanted to become a wrestler. You know, it was at the time one of those type of things like, oh, I want to be a fireman, I want to be an astronaut, you know, because I was one of those kids who, you know, wanted to basically be everything he thought was cool. I want to play second base for the Red Sox because Marty Barrett was second base.
Good old Marty Barrett.
But my favorite house show memory that I was telling you about was in 1990, November 1990, November 1st. So they were starting Sergeant Slaughter. And I looked it up earlier. I can't remember if he worked I think he worked Volkoff. So he must have been in the Volkoff run because I think he went Volkoff and then Duggan while they were warming him up for Hogan on all the house shows.
This is the start of his heel turn. This is when Volkoff became Lithuanian good guy.
Like
American Lithuanian.
Because at WrestleMania 6 earlier that year, you know, they did the job, him and Zukov did the job in like 10 seconds to Hart Foundation, and then they did a job to them, they put him over again like a couple weeks later or something like that on TV. And so then they did that split. But so Sergeant Slaughter was doing the Iraqi heel gimmick.
Yeah.
And when he came out, at some point during the match, this absolutely happened, I'm not making this up, my friend's dad went to the bathroom. And so 12-year-old Matt decided to take the – can I swear on this?
Yeah, I don't give a shit.
So I completely let loose in the Centrum in Worcester with like, fuck you to Sergeant Slaughter because he's doing the whole Iraqi gimmick. And I have this memory, you know, I'm sure it's trumped up in my head somewhat, but I have this memory of people around me being like, well, you know, I'm not going to stop him. To me, it was like, you know, he's right. I'm not going to stop him. Well, he's not my kid. And so my friend's dad, I do remember he stayed gone for a while. And after everything was done, I look over and he was standing at the end of the row. I'm like, oh my god, I think he knew what was happening and he didn't want to stop me either from just cussing up his form. So he's just like, you know, it's like when I joined the Marine Corps, I used to say, it's like, look, if I don't see something, I can't object to it. So if you're gonna be screwing around, don't let me see it.
Oh, baby face to the end. I love it.
That's one of those type of things where you're like, man, I wish, like, one of those top five moments in your personal history. I'm like, I would absolutely love to do the Ghost of Christmas Past thing and be able to go see that and go watch myself.
Slaughter had heat then, though. That was, like, genuine, like,
yeah,
like could have been stabbed in the crowd. Like, he had, like, there were stories of him getting, like, bomb threats at his house and shit like that. Like, that was, like, that was one of the last real, true, like, genuine danger to yourself and others heat angles.
But that was, like, I mean, that was dangerous fuck you heat,
yeah.
You know? And, you know, they had to move, considering they had to move WrestleMania because security concerns.
Well.
you know, obviously it was the wrong type of heat, but I remember fire and consider, you know, 6 years later, November 1st, 1996, I'm in boot camp in Paris Island. So,
yeah. So let's go there. Cause you didn't end up, you got out of school and you didn't end up becoming a wrestler. You ended up joining the Marines.
Yeah, I didn't want to go to college. I had enough of school, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that I didn't want to go to college yet. I'm an intelligent person. I didn't do particularly great in school because it bored me. I could have done well had I applied myself, but I just had no desire. And then a Marine Corps recruiter called, and That was it. And it's funny because at one of those shows, I actually had the Killer Kowalski shows. I actually remember saying to him, like, so you run a wrestling school? And he just nodded. I'm like, so do you accept students? And he just nodded. And that was my conversation with Killer Kowalski as he signed my program for his wrestling show.
So without revealing national secrets, talk a little bit about your experience in the Marines. Cause you served two tours.
I was a 4-year contract and then I reenlisted and did another 4 years.
Yeah.
And funny enough, the day I reenlisted, I did an indie show. I went, it was the last Steel City Wrestling show. It was like a random Tuesday or something like that. And it was set as my reenlistment date, and I was able to convince them to give me a day off, the day off starting at noon after I reenlisted, to jump in the car, and then I had to be back at noon the next day.
Did you start training while you were in the military?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because so this overlaps then. Okay, I thought you started training after you got out. Maybe you're sorry. Okay. So wrestling kind of overlaps with the military then?
Completely. So I was in Quantico, Virginia. I still follow wrestling because when I was doing, when I was in boot camp, obviously. Actually, I got wrestling newsletters in boot camp. Right before I got in, I had gotten some samples of the Observer because I'd written to Meltzer and said, like, hey, I'd be interested in sampling your newsletter. And he put me on the list, and I got, like, 4 of them. The first Observer newsletter I got in 96 was his first Hall of Fame, which must have been, like, 24 pages. Mm-hmm. And then I started
getting 170 inductees.
I mean, you know, because that was when he started it. That was his initial class, and I thought it was great. But I also got it like a month. Started getting it a month before I went to boot camp, and I was getting the chatterbox. And I used to get the chatterbox sent to me in boot camp, for real. So this is how I was following wrestling. Now you have to recall to know the last thing I saw before boot camp, because I shipped out on a Tuesday. On a Monday, that was when they started the fake sting thing in like September.
Oh, jeez.
So I should go look that, but they started like, I think that was when they started the fake sting heel turn. And then I was in boot camp.
So you just didn't know any better.
I mean, I was getting sent stuff. I had watched the Great American Bash in 96 Live, which was just such a fantastic pay-per-view. And then, of course the Hogan turn, but then I went to a WCW house show in that time as well, which was really cool, in Hartford, Connecticut.
Among the worst cities on the planet.
I have no memories of Hartford, Connecticut, except finding a cigar store before the house show. That may have been the only time I've really been to Hartford, except for driving through. So I went to boot camp, and in 97, when I got out and I was at my schooling in Maryland, Nitro and Raw, the war was going on, you know, very full-fledged. There were two TVs in my in the room where we were, the break room in my barracks. And at times on Monday nights, we had them both. On one hand we'd have Raw and the other we'd have Nitro, and some of us would stand in the middle when both were going on. We would literally stand in the middle and go watch one or the other.
So in the military at the time, wrestling was huge.
I mean, it was where I was.
Sure.
Because I was one of the ones who was, of course, spurring it on to watch wrestling. And I was very interested in that because I had a TV in my room. I went out. I had bought a TV. I was at this duty station for like 7 months, but no cable. So I was watching TVs that I purchased from a provider of VHS tapes in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, a.k.a. RF Video.
Ixnay on the RFA.
LOL.
I'll pretend you said... anyone else.
And I was consuming a lot of wrestling, and then after I finished my training, because you do boot camp and then you basically do your schooling to learn what your actual job in the Marine Corps is.
Yeah.
I got stationed at Quantico, Virginia and I, you know, there was groups that were, there were some groups that were running around the area. So I found one, and in like, and in 98, I started going to, IPWA, which was, what is it? Independent Professional Wrestling Alliance, which had, it was run by Q-Ball Carmichael and, Kevin Carson. He was a ring announcer, basically like a wrestler and Scott Hensley type deal. It was really cool. They ran shows that brought in, they had Julio Sanchez, Steve Corino, Joey Matthews and Christian York were also trained by Q-Ball Carmichael.
Oh, that's cool.
Jimmy Cicero, Tom Brandy. And at the time in 98 for the area we were in, this was a very high class card. And of course, as I do, I started bugging Q-Ball Carmichael about stuff. Cause I was like, hey, you know, I was not an athlete in high school. I was definitely a late bloomer, but I went through Marine Corps boot camp really without much of a problem. I actually thought boot camp was going to be harder. That's not trying to make me sound good. I just thought it was going to be physically tougher.
Were there other military guys also in the wrestling school, or were you kind of an anomaly?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I you know, we started talking about it because I heard that he had trained Joey and Christian, and he did not have a training center at the time. He didn't have a ring or have access. So what he did, and this ended up paying so many dividends today as to why I'm a pretty good promoter and I understand the business as, you know, fairly well. I'm not going to say I'm great at it. I'm not any sort of great wrestling business mind, but I do know things that, you know, I do know how to do conduct business. But he basically young boyed me. He put me on the road with him. He said, look, you drive and I'll pay for gas and you can come to all these shows. So I'm 20. Gosh, at the time I'm 20 years old and I'm, you know, I'm older than Joey Matthews. You know, Joey Mercury. He was like 16. He was wrestling. So it's not like 20 is young, but I had no experience to wrestling at all. I didn't go into a ring and take a bump for not quite a year, I think, before, you know, when he was taking me on the road. But he would take me to Maryland Championship Wrestling shows, and it's like there's Jim Cornette, Tommy Dreamer, Rob Van Dam, freaking Yokozuna, Matt and Jeff Hardy, and I'm just in the locker room as his guy, and I'm seeing how Maryland Championship Wrestling, a super quality independent show, is run.
And you're just taking notes.
I mean, I didn't even know it at the time. Believe it or not, later the fact that I got such a good kind of background in wrestling hurt me, because when I transferred to Louisiana in the year 2000, after I reenlisted, it was a dead zone, and I assumed that it was independent wrestling was like it was everywhere, like where I started. I thought it was like that everywhere, and it wasn't. And I learned that there are a lot of people coming up in wrestling who didn't have that education that I did. I didn't know that people weren't taught how to conduct business or how to string matches together, you know, as a wrestler. I just didn't know that bad training schools existed, you know. But I did get a great education, and of course Q-Ball is talking to me the entire time. He's telling me stories, and you know, we're talking wrestling, and he was educating me on the route. I mean, he will on his Facebook page, you know, put me over as, you know, I was the student of his that got the most unique training, because this was months and months. We'd go to Maryland, Pennsylvania, North Carolina.
All while you're enlisted, by the way.
Yes, I had to do this. You know, I was able to get a little bit of flexibility, because when I was in Quantico, my job, sometimes I had to work late, so sometimes I could get a little flexibility with hours. But, you know, Maryland Championship was running on a Sunday night, so I had to, of course, drop him off and hurry up and get back for Monday morning. But I'd go to North Carolina. We were at the ECW Super 8 in 1999. I'd been training, I don't know what month they do the Super 8 in. Maybe it was like March at the time, but whatever one. 99, the finals were Steve Bradley and Chris Daniels.
Oh, cool.
And I was, and Matt and Jeff Hardy were both in it. And Q-Ball was invited to the show. I guess he said he got paid, so I guess he was booked and they didn't use him. I'm not sure if they were doing the battle royals on the Super 8 gimmicks at the time, because two or three years later, I ended up working one of those battle royals, which was very, very cool. But like, you know, that was a great experience. I mean, I literally sat and watched Steve Bradley, who was incredibly underrated. Rest in peace. He was, yeah. That was the only time I met him. He was nice.
Died real young too, right?
Yeah,
like mid-30s, right?
I'm not sure. I kind of followed his career, but it's not like you could watch, you know, there wasn't YouTube where you could watch matches of Steve Bradley out of Memphis. But, you know, I always have an affinity. I'm very simple in this way. If you're nice to me, you know, if you're a good guy to me, I'm always constantly, you know, that's a big deal to me. I don't like to big time people. You know, like at Scenic City last weekend, I'm afraid that I had to almost big time people because, you know, I'm literally got to handle something else that's coming up and I can't make time to talk to somebody. But you know, it's such a big deal. Like Chris Daniels and Steve Bradley, let me watch them putting their match together. And it's kind of, I was learning, you know, I had only been training for a few months, but I'm learning just watching them. They're like, okay, you know, and this is both the third match of the night. Okay. If I do this, if I move you, I'm probably going to go ahead and boom, you know, they're not calling out a match so much as calling out what they might do. And if I grab you like this, and lift you, I'm going to bump you like this. You know, it was very, very, I got a good education. I got a very good wrestling education.
Whatever happened to that Chris Daniels guy, you know?
He signed with WCW, but they went out of business, so I don't know.
Nothing came of him. You know, never had any good matches after that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some stuff on YouTube if you look really hard, do a deep dive.
Yeah, do a real deep dive, yeah. That's real cool though. So you're enlisted in your wrestling. I mean, I never heard of a situation like that. That's amazing. So do you have to hide it from your commanding officers, or are they find this entertaining?
No, I didn't. You know, and I've heard of people who've been like in kind of public civic jobs. I remember someone who was like an active duty firefighter, and they said he could wrestle if he was always a babyface and wore a mask. I've encountered other people who were, you know, like National Guards or reserves, and they've been able to slide through. But I was 100% active duty. Like I lived on the base. I lived on Marine Corps Base Quantico, Monday through Friday. Is, you know, I was going to work in camouflage, so. I didn't really have to hide it. Everybody knew I was a big wrestling fan. I tried not to over broadcast it too much until I was comfortable with it. And then in my last year at Quantico, before I left, I ended up actually running a show. That was the first show I promoted. I didn't book it, but I promoted an IPWA show, on Quantico at the Quantico High School. I still have the show poster, though. What we actually put on was not exactly what was on the poster, because Buddy Landell was booked.
Old Budrow.
Al Getz has said the best tribute to Buddy Landell would be to have a tribute show and everybody no show. So, that's a shame. But yeah, wrestling. Now, eventually I did get heat. I got a lot of heat from my master sergeant, because they switched. My master sergeant before, it's your staff non-commissioned officer in charge, she was fine. She retired. And somebody came in who was a bit of a hard ass. He gave me some crap about stuff. And it was interesting because it's like, of all the things that I did with wrestling, I got accused of doing something that I absolutely was not doing. Because in the Marine Corps, depending on how long you're off work, whether you have a 48 hours of liberty, or if you have a 3-day weekend, it's a 72, or a 4-day weekend, it's a 96. You have certain boundaries that you're allowed to drive. Like, you're not allowed to be more than 500 miles away or something, or 300 miles away if you're just on a regular weekend. So it's so funny. It was so weird that I was accused of being out of bounds every weekend. And I'm like, I'm absolutely not, because I study this damn map that is posted, and I specifically you know, these are rules I absolutely follow. You know, it was definitely difficult. But you know, the thing with being in the Marine Corps and being a wrestler is I was able to invest in myself. That's a term I use a lot with wrestlers. There's guys who invest in themselves a lot, and the biggest example I can think of now is somebody like Steve Manders, guys like AJ Gray who really take chances and get out there and work notable places, and they don't worry about paydays. They've taken the time to be solid and have a good financial back. You know, they've got a good financial footing for whatever reason. I knew that I was getting my check from the Marine Corps deposited, and I knew exactly how much it was going to be. I didn't have to worry about tip money. If I missed a day of work because of, you know, some reason or another, it wouldn't matter. I knew exactly what it was going to be. So I was able to go ahead and
hit the road.
Yeah, I was able to do all these big, these good indie shows and not worry about paydays. So that was a really big deal for me.
So one thing I want to touch on, because you were in the military during 9/11, and you touched on this a little bit during Between the Sheets, but just give a brief synopsis of what your role was during 9/11, and for those people who didn't hear Between the Sheets, what your experience of what happened then.
Yeah, those Between the Sheets I did with Chris Zellner and David Bixon's band that I don't remember the exact day it dropped, mm-hmm. but it would have been
around 9/11, actually.
Yeah, it would have been that week of 9/11. I'm sorry, I don't remember the date, but it was September 2018. We taped that. So at this point, I had reenlisted and moved to New Orleans, and I'd been in New Orleans for about a year. And 9/11 was on a Tuesday. Now, the date I enlisted in the Marine Corps was September 10th, 96. And I specifically remember I used to play softball. I had a softball game. I got a here's how serious the softball games in the military were. We'd often in New Orleans go out and buy a daiquiri, because Mondays and Wednesday nights when the games were, you had $5 daiquiri specials. They served to you in a 32-ounce styrofoam cup, and you're basically just drinking and playing.
Why, it's my favorite city on the planet.
Oh my God, it was such a bad idea for me to live there. And you know, I remember going home, just kind of having after it, just having a drink, kind of like, all right, happy 5 years to me. You know, it's a Monday night, and then the world went to shit the next day. Now my captain and my gunnery sergeant, basically the two above me in the office, there were a couple of Marines below me, but the two above me in the office were actually at a conference in California during the week of 9/11. So,
and what was your job? What was your job in the military?
I was a combat correspondent. When I was in New Orleans, I was attached. Well, you're attached to a public affairs office, which, if it sounds like you're dealing with the public and dealing with community relations and dealing with newspapers and media inquiries, that's exactly what it is. So that was a busy week, because I was essentially trying to, from Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I was trying to direct Marines who were used to dealing with a captain and who all basically outranked me. And I was the one having to sit in on conference calls. It was very weird, because this was a public affairs conference. So lots of people in my field were stuck in California. And eventually, most of them just rented cars to get back. But I was, it's not like I was putting on camouflage and ready to go overseas or anything like that. But there was a lot of fallout. There was some potential for some bad optics on some stories that the Marines did not get involved in, that some of the other services fell into in my district that week. It's very uncomfortable when you're a sergeant and you're trying to tell an officer, a captain or major, that he won't be doing something, that yes, you have the authority in this situation. I mean, that's essentially like an assistant manager telling, you know, one of the Waltons what's going to happen at their store. It was a very, very interesting and shitty week. And then I still made the town because NWA Wildside still did TV on the 15th, and I got to wash all everything away and go wrestle, which was very therapeutic for me.
Talk about and NWA Wildside because that was, go ahead.
I just want to note that I still made the town. I didn't have to cancel because there was a dusting of snow. I still made the damn town.
I don't know anybody who's ever canceled because of dusting of snow. Never heard of him.
If Mike Blanton hears that, he's gonna get such a kick out of that.
Never heard of him. NWA Wildside, would you say that was your biggest break as a wrestler?
Oh, without a doubt. I had I was the champion for a while and still did some shows with NWA Virginia. And I made contact with somebody who was at NWA Wildside. I met Rick Michaels. He was brought in for a show, and I was kind of like, hey, I live in Louisiana. You know, I'm going to be going to Georgia to spend some time with family over the holidays. You know, I'd be interested. And he gave me Bill Barron's email address, and he did me a favor. He's like, hey, tell Bill I said, you know, to have you come in. And I went on a show. They used to run Friday nights every Friday night that were like the training school shows. Whoever shows up is going to get booked. There were like 17 people because the first show I went in was the day after Thanksgiving. And I wrestled Marky Mark, who later became Azrael.
And your wrestler name, by the way?
JC North.
Mr. Delicious.
Of course you remember that. Yes, nobody ever lets me forget that.
Burned into my retinas.
And I got to go. I did a shot, and then I was back up there for Christmas from New Orleans to Georgia because I have family in Georgia. And I went to Christmas Chaos with my gear. I was totally expecting not to work because Christmas Chaos was one of the big quarterly shows. This is when the WCW deal was happening with NWA Wildside. So they had like the Young Dragons there. They had Bob Sapp. They had a huge assortment of talent there.
Did you get to interact with Bob Sapp?
Oh my God. Let me finish the story and then ask.
Okay.
Because now I'm very insulted that you've never watched my highlight reel. So this guy, Romeo Bliss, and I got to tell him this at the NWA Wildside reunion a couple years ago, did me the hugest favor. He no-showed. He had travel issues, so he couldn't make it. So the first match was in the ring, Suicidal Tendencies and the Young Dragons. And I hear Bill getting this message that he's not going to be there. And I just say to Bill, I'm like, you know, I have my stuff in the car. And I remember he looks up. Oh, and this is the first time I've met Bill. I've corresponded with him, but this is the first time I've met him. He never seen me work. He didn't know anything about me, but this is the type of person that Bill Barron's is. He's always willing to give somebody a shot. So he looks at me. He's like, okay, you're wrestling David Flair third. Now, my gear is in my car. The first match is in the ring. So David Flair was very cool with me. We ended up doing just basically about a 2.5 minute squash job. And it was cool because it was a chance, you know, it was a chance to go ahead and show that I can do business, that I'm an easy person to meet everybody. Always bring your gear.
Says the promoter.
Wrestlers always bring their gear. And that worked out for me. 3 months later, I was up in Georgia, and they had another big quarterly show. And I was there, and Bill likes to try to use everybody he can. So I got put in a 6-man match against the Platoon and Marky Mark. I forget one of my partner's names because I don't think I ever saw him again. But the third partner was Bob Sapp. So Bob let me call a spot. I got to call this spot. And, you know, we powdered all of them to the outside right in front of the hard cam because there's a big dive zone right in front of the hard cam. That we did a tag, like Bob Sapp was tagged. He tags me. And I go to post ups because he's going to gorilla press me and go and toss me on to all three of them. And I didn't have to post. And I felt like I was more secure than anything because he lifted me up and oh my God, he presses me and you can see it. My arms are waving. He just pressed me over his head like I was nothing.
It's amazing.
Tosses me onto them and it was stellar.
One of the greatest men ever.
I met him twice. And once I got to team with him, and he was a gigantic human being, and he was very cool.
He's what, legit, like what, like 6'6", 6'7", right?
Oh, God, I don't know. But he is not just muscular. He is very, very tall. I'd have to look back at that to see. But he completely dwarfs me. He just worked in, like, basketball shorts. It was funny. Oh,
God. And his Japanese commercials, if you've ever seen them, unbelievable stuff.
I know I'd seen some back in the day because I got a kick out of the fact that Bob Sapp completely blew up and was just such a gigantic star over there. But, you know, that was all, you know, he was on a WCW
power plant stuff, right?
Yeah, but at the time, I mean, 2001, when he was there, it had WCW had collapsed or was about to collapse. Mm-hmm. When did they get sold?
Well, May of 2001, or March of 2001. March of 2001. So this was the tail end when they were the tail end of the guys working the power plant, yeah.
So I think this was about the same weekend because mm-hmm. I remember that when I watched Vince on Nitro on a Monday. And I think I had just been up there 2 days before because I specifically would go stay with family and I would always do these trips and try to structure it around. So like, hey, are there indie shows I can make shots at and, you know, at least meet people and maybe it'll work out. Maybe it won't.
So you wrestled in the Georgia scene for a while. Any other notable guys you wrestled and talk about your career a little bit?
I did NWA Wildside from... really the very end of 2000 to 2005 when Wildside shut up shop. But I didn't really work the Georgia scene in any other promotions till like 2004. Because in 2004, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I moved to Georgia. So then I was really able to. I was just coming in strictly for Wildside TVs. Mm-hmm. But I worked... I worked Jimmy Rave. I worked AJ Styles. I did a program that Murder One was on the end of, and eventually Murder One and I did a big program for another group that was a riot because they let us do all sorts of shit we wanted. Like, all right, fans bring the weapons. Yep, Murder One. I'm trying to press his hand. He's got thumbtacks. He's trying to make stick in my bald forehead. And for some reason, they wouldn't stick in. The funny part is with thumbtacks is they do not hurt that bad for me. When I get a little bit of adrenaline, they did not hurt that bad.
I can make a joke about your thick skull, but I won't.
We seriously could not get him to stick in my forehead. I mean, he's like, I'm trying to pull him off and I'm really trying to press his hand in and he's just, as hard as he could, we couldn't get the iceberg gimmick. I don't know if I just don't have enough, you know, where iceberg would constantly have his forehead full of thumbtacks. We couldn't do it. But yeah, I ended up working, in Rome. I know Tank was booking it at the time in like 2004. That was like NAWA. And then I started working the pre to AWE, which was Josh Wheeler and Murder One, was called like Pro Wrestling Evolution or PWE or something along those lines. I worked for them. And then I worked for, I'm sure, a few other groups too.
How was working AJ?
It was cool, except for the fact that I was completely 100% out of my element.
Most people are.
I can't even bullshit it. I mean, I was, lots of times I felt at least if I was behind somebody, I wasn't too far behind somebody. I was completely 100% outclassed. I mean, I had no business being sharing the ring with him.
So you had a solid wrestling career. Then did you kind of retired when?
You know, I will say the thing I'm most proud of mm-hmm. is with my wrestling career is I never had any real appreciable athletic talent. That's just a fact. I didn't have any real skill or talent, but I was able to work for years. I worked Wildside TV for years. I tell this all the time, so I can't believe I forgot, but I worked Slim J. Slim J and I also teamed together against, Mike Pittman, and Mike Pittman's hero was Joey Matthews.
There you go.
So, that was a big match for him. I remember, Joey was trying to call something and was asking Pitty something about what he did. He's like, "I don't care what we do. You're Joey Matthews." And Joey's like, "Don't ever fucking say that again." But I got in PWIs. I worked two NWA conventions. I was there and saw it all when Shinya Hashimoto supposedly shot and killed Carino, and it was the fakest looking thing. They did it in front of. Do you know what I'm talking about? This incident.
Vaguely heard about it.
So it was in Tampa, and this was actually like a month. This was like October 2001. So it was like a month after 9/11. So not everything had, calmed down yet. But I drove over there with Kevin Northcutt, who was on the show doing an NWA Southwest match. But he lived near New Orleans, too, so we drove over there together. Shinya Hashimoto and Steve Carino. Hashimoto basically, kicks the shit out of Carino, and there was a bunch of Japanese photographers there. So they do one of those angles where, the ref and all the NWA officials are – basically working the photographers, except they were also trying to work the boys as well about this being an injury and Hashimoto, quote, going off script or however you want to say it, except it was faker than shit. And they should have clued us in to at least sell something, because this was not the angle with Carino and Hashimoto was believable. The problem was that the NWA people and the ref and everything were faker than shit. And I'm like, okay, this is really badly scripted. Like, what the fuck is going on here? Oh, they're working for the... they're doing a Japanese angle.
Ah, gotcha. So it's for the Japanese papers or the Japanese magazines.
And I was like, oh, but so many of the workers, because there's so many guys there. This was at the IPW. I forget what that's called, but they had their own arena, kind of similar to the way, that it was set up, like the Landmark Arena or other places.
Sure, yeah.
That owned the building. And, yeah, it was a weird friggin' show.
So you wrestled until...
I pretty much stopped about 2007.
Sure.
And 2007 or 2008.
So we'll get on your wrestling career. Let me pay the bills here, and then we will get into you getting back in the business. So on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, Todd Weber brings back Weber Has Issues in a new pod blast, talking about three new Marvel books and how accessible they are to comic fans. This time around, it's Marvel's Epilogue by Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross, History of the Marvel Universe number 1 for Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez, and the much-hyped House of X number 1 by Jonathan Hickman and Pepe Larraz. Jenny and Tim flipped the script on this episode of Talkin' Pop by welcoming multi-show host, multi-talented Andy Atherton for a journey that touches on Andy's adventures as a podcaster, producer, screenwriter, bartender, DJ, and choreographer. The hard-traveling fanboys debut a new potentially ongoing theme, Fix It or Forget It. Our first is Jonah Hex, starring Josh Brolin and Megan Fox. Pop Goes the Movies, where Andy and J.R. Senior D'Amato get to discuss the latest summer movie release, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. On New Sunday Groove, David talks his current favorite songs, new movie Yesterday, The Beatles. JT joins Andy to talk about Kevin Smith's Dogma, the latest and greatest edition of Laugh-In Theater. DC4U is back with their first week of Justice League Month. Russell and Todd discuss the JLA's greatest stories, adapted media and creators, only in the DC4U podcast. They also discuss the divisive Snyder Cut. The greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. There'll be 6 polls a day posted for round 2. You can get in the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament and liking the page. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, I welcome Pete to Row 1, Seat 1, and we talked SCI. No Holds Barred is back. Aaron and JT return with a GWE PPV TV match ever-focused episode. In the latest edition of the Place to Be podcast, JT Scott and John D'Amato break down Survivor Series 89. On the newest ECW-focused PTB and Extreme Three-Way Dance, GT Rosero, JT Smith, and John D'Amato review the first ECW show. On PlaceToBeNation.com, PlaceToBeNation's tribute to 94 is off and running with a brand new piece on Woodstock 94, and a piece where JT looks at Bob Backlund challenging Bret Hart for the WWF title on Superstars. Glenn's Weekly Walk is back as well. and on our social media pages on bigelow.34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWE PPV TV Match Ever project. Get in the conversation, start researching your lists. So what made you get the bug back into wrestling? Because you became, you got back into civilian life and got out of it. And then I met you about 5 years ago, and you had you were actually filming Scenic City, the first one. And you were working a little bit with Anarchy at that point as well, correct?
I just walked away. I didn't do any sort of retirement match. I did a match at Dragon Con, because Dragon Con in Atlanta has a wrestling show in conjunction with their gigantic convention. It's actually a lot of fun. They pack this place out. There's literally no seats left, and they get something like we're told they get something like 2,000 people in there. I have no idea if that's a shoot or not, but
that con is huge. I mean, yeah.
I mean into this ballroom to watch the wrestling show.
Oh, sure, yeah, okay.
2,000. That's what they say. I know last year I did the show. I did like the Battle Royal gimmick, and they shut the doors. I had to bring a friend in through the locker room to get him in the building.
Jeez.
Because they literally wouldn't let any more fans in. But I walked away. The indie scene was nothing like it is today in the Southeast or in Georgia. I was getting a little bit out of shape, and I'd had some concussions. And I generally just was like, I'm done. The one promotion I was working for was run by Speedy Nelson, former Wildside ref. Rest in peace. Very good guy to me. He was losing his building and was a fold up, and I just decided I was done. I started doing improv comedy after a couple of years because I wanted some other outlet and creative outlet, and you know that was going well. And then for the first Scenic City, Al Getz, you know, he knew that I knew the film industry, so I would be able to work a camera pretty well. He, you know, because to film wrestling, you need a couple talents to understand wrestling, to be able to follow the flow and where they're going and how a shot should be framed. And plus, you have to be able to operate a camera. It's not necessarily the easiest thing. I really didn't have a problem with it. I was like, okay, when, you know, it'd be good to see some of the guys again, because guys like Tank were booked that I knew. I'd helped out Al at one other show a few months earlier that I regretted, because it was not good. I'm not going to bury anybody who are not, you know, nice people working hard, but I absolutely hated it, because I was like, I've been retired for years. I'm standing behind a camera. I'm not in good cardio shape, and I could outwork half the guys on the show.
Sure.
right now. And I absolutely hate feeling like that. But I did production with SCI, first year. I did video work. You know, the first 2 years, 2015, 2016, you see me, all over the hard cam, cause I'm there filming, and it was cool. It was good because it was a reintroduction back into wrestling. And Tank, you know, I know you love Tank. I got to work him back in Wildside as well. That was our first real big match, was with each other in a tag match. And it's funny because Tank's had a much longer career than I did, because he kept going years after I retired. And at that 2015 SCI, we were talking about it. He's like, oh yeah, we did this, we did this, we did this, we did this. And I was like, how do you remember all that?
And that dude's got a memory. We talk all the time, and he just, like, he's got a memory on him like you wouldn't believe.
This is what Tank said to me, and this actually touched me. He said, I always remember the good stuff.
Aww.
That meant, and I've told him that too, so that, you know, that shouldn't surprise him if he were to listen to this or tell him. But I told him that meant a lot to me. And that was good. And that first year was cool, but they really were just two wrestling shows. They really were. They were good. They were good wrestling shows, but they were in the Empire Arena in Rossville. You know, it was. I got to see Caprice Coleman, who I hadn't seen in years, which was cool. You know, there's a lot of guys who were new to me, and it was weird being around wrestling because, like I said, I've been around a show and I was like, I can outwork half these guys and I'm not even in good shape. That's an indictment of, you know, that's not a compliment to me. That's just an indictment of guys who are just absolutely, you know, whatever. But, you know, that and that kind of attitude carried over to 2016 where it was tough. I hadn't adjusted to not being an active wrestler and being around it. So 2016, you know, everyone was having fun. I that Saturday afternoon, I left and I went to I went far away from wrestling. I went to you know, everyone's at the Heritage Inn. I was in when they did the Tank and Riddle deal with the podcast. I was in there for a while and I saw that, and then I left. I went to the movies before the second show. I couldn't. You know, it was tough for me to be around it. I hadn't had that moment where I had a disconnection where I'm not an active wrestler anymore and I'm okay with it. But I quit doing it. But to make a short story really, really long, I quit doing improv comedy because I wasn't seeing much traction there or much of a future. I'd always wanted to run wrestling shows. I've run comedy benefits for a domestic violence shelter and resource down here, and I'd always wanted to run something for Make-A-Wish because I'm very heavily involved with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And I had conversations probably a year and a half before Action was even before we even had our first show with people at Make-A-Wish about running a wrestling benefit for them. And I didn't have anything yet. I didn't have a ring guy. I didn't have a building. I did some searching for buildings. Patrick Alvarez helped me. You know, we tried discussing what areas, but everything we found as far as a building was just far too expensive. And then in my town, my town of Tyrone, they've run wrestling at their Founders Day Festival every October for years. This is a show where they had where I brought Gangrel in.
Yeah, the outdoor show, yeah.
Let's just say that they were absolutely shitty shows, and yes, I do have video proof because I was like so appalled at one show that's taken place less than a quarter of a mile away from my house that I started filming it and doing my own commentary. I even put it out on what's it called? What's the Facebook Live but for Twitter? Periscope.
Oh yeah.
And so I have this show that's just absolute dog shit. And there's guys, a couple guys on the show who, not that I ever use or associate with, but who are still doing indie shows today, and it was god awful. But I saw a couple of them, and in 16 and 17, and I ended up happening to meet the recreation director a week after the show, and he's like, "Hey, were you at the wrestling deal?" And I was like, "Yes, I was," and I was inside the Action Arena, what's now the Action Arena. I had kind of discovered it, and he was there, and we had a conversation, and we hit it off, and it was like I booked a building for, God, 6 months later to be able to run a wrestling show. And that's how that started.
That's the genesis of Action Wrestling.
Yeah. I have a friend you know, who's rest in peace, Charles Anschutz, who started Southern Fried Championship Wrestling, and you know, he said he would give me a fair rate on a ring, and you know, I'm still friends with and very close with Southern Fried today. David Manders, no relation to Steve Manders, but David Manders is a hell of a guy and a good friend. And I get to use his ring and his skill and his intimidation factor for when we need security.
Man, David's a good guy. David's real, just salt of the earth guy, definitely.
And I wanted to run shows. There were some things that I wanted to do. I wanted shows that I ran to matter outside of the building that I ran them in. Meaning I didn't want to just run for my own ego so that people could come and be like, you know, I drew however many people and that's it. I wanted to run shows where we put out content on the internet. You know, where guys could be seen and get some exposure. Because you very well know that attendance size doesn't matter as far as the importance of a show.
Oh, there definitely.
There are plenty of shows in the Southeast that outdraw the Scenic City, even if you combine both nights. But Scenic City matters a ton more than many other shows. And I wanted Action to be something similar. I wanted Action to matter. I wanted it to be seen. You know, I wanted people to see it, and that's why I'm glad we have the Independent Wrestling TV partnership. and you know, like, at, you know, through Scenic City and through other promotions, you know, guys from Action have gotten to Scenic City and gotten into Southern Underground Pro. It's almost like a little circuit where we've you know, guys have gotten exposure. I've got two other deals with promotions where I'm going to be sending cars of guys. I'm going to be getting them out. That's what I really wanted to do. I wanted to be somebody who was, you know, I don't want to be an agent. I don't want to make any money off of the wrestlers, but I want talent like the Action Champ, AC Mack, to be able to get out there and to show, you know, in the Northeast and the Midwest and in other areas, to show what a talented guy he is, because he deserves a contract.
And that was one thing that I really enjoy about SCI, is that there is promoters there, and there's, I mean, it's a scouting combine, really, and, you know, action shows as well. But it's, you know, the one thing that I really noticed, and you know, we'll get to your role in SCI in a minute, but one thing I noticed about SCI is everybody's, you know, everybody in SCI got 10 bookings off that show.
SCI matters a ton. You know, these type of shows.
In Action, I mean, people has a good performance in Action, and it gets traction on, you know, IWTV. You know, someone gets a booking off of an Action show. You know, someone gets a booking off of SUP. Someone gets a, you know, it buzzes real. You know,
look at you can look at Southern Underground Pro. Look at who they have, and you can also see that I've brought in guys from Southern Underground Pro here. You know, and there, you know, in some cases, I won't name names because there are potentially future plans, but in some cases, the reason some guys haven't shown up is it just doesn't work to get from Nashville for their schedule to get from Nashville to Atlanta on a Friday, on a Friday afternoon. But you know, there's been, you know, deals made both ways. There's deals we're discussing with other promoters. You know, the importance of Scenic City is not just being on this weekend, but what it can mean for a wrestler's career outside of that, because you need to get booked. If you want to be a hometown hero and it, you know, just you know, work a couple times a month, you can absolutely do that in Georgia easily. But I want wrestlers who are hungry to get out there and do other things.
I think Action has that gravitas. I think that, you know, you hear, you know, a lot of these podcasts and you see a lot of the buzz on Twitter and things like that. Action has gravitas across the country. You know, people are seeing it in, I mean, you know, Keith from England and I were talking about it. You know, I mean, people in other parts of the country were talking about Action. You know, and it's, IWTV has that weight, you know, and I think that's a great thing about it. You know, I mean, and you draw a healthy house. You really do. You fill that building up. It's standing room only in the Action, you know, in the Action building. But you know, you're not drawing 1,000, but you're drawing a healthy 250 and 225, you know, I mean, up to 300 in some cases, you know, that's healthy, you know, but there's 10 times that, you know, watching on IWTV.
You know, that's something that we really want to do is God, we just want to make sure that we get our talent exposed. If I was just a vain promoter and I wanted to just cared about running my hometown for my own vanity, then I wouldn't care about getting guys out there. But I want Action to matter. You know, I don't want to say anything to spoil, but there was more than one match Scenic City weekend that just by virtue of the in-ring work helped guys get booked other places because of as it was happening. There were wrestlers and promoters reacting to what they were watching in real time to me and around me that, you know, things are going to happen for these wrestlers. So that's why Scenic City is important. That's the real lasting mark of SCI in independent wrestling right now.
And you're part of SCI.
You know, we
haven't touched on that, but you're part of the SCI booking team. That's, and your role in that in the last what, year or so?
Yes. So, you know, I did production in 2015-16. 2017, I helped call times and keep the trains running on schedule. I was also at the Rumble and Trios and helping out with such things, and just kind of being around, even though I wasn't a decision maker. Last year after Action started in April 2018, you know, I talked with Scott Hensley, my ring announcer, and Dylan Hales, my commentator, quite a bit. They were on the booking team with SCI. There were some guys who were going to bow out off the booking team, and Scott's the one who drives the ship. Scott Hensley does an incredible job with SCI, and you know, after Action had gone so well, and he saw that I had good ideas booking, and he asked if I'd join him and Dylan because that was going to be the new team going forward. So the first show I had impact on, because we were discussing things before 2018 SCI, but it was already booked. The first show I had impact on were the trios and Rumble shows.
Sure.
For 2018 and 19. But even so, that Rumble, the Rumble was booked long before. The AC Mac idea of him winning like that was booked long before I had any decision-making say, which I loved it, and I would have absolutely been in favor of it. But it's great. We have a very good chemistry, I feel. Dylan, Scott, and I, you know, we're actually friends. We actually enjoy being around each other. There's nobody I'd rather discuss wrestling with than those guys, as far as from a booking standpoint and trying to make things happen.
Well, and me, right?
Yes, I do. No, I do, but from a different capacity. You know, I specifically try not to discuss any ideas with you because I know you don't want to be spoiled. And sure. Even, you know, I have fans who say stuff, and I will sometimes throw them off because it's like, you know, I denied that Kane Justice was even going to be at SCI. I was like, oh, maybe next year, brother. Sorry, can't be there. You know, and I'm like, at the time, Kane Justice was going to be working Allen Angels on Futures. You know, because people are trying to – I wish fans would just let things happen. Because
no, I particularly – and this is something I genuinely do. I particularly tell my promoter friends to kayfabe me because yeah. I don't want to know. You know, I like to be find out. I like to find out organically.
That is absolutely how it should be, because you know, I'm very rarely surprised by anything in wrestling anymore, because you know, and that's just a byproduct of being around so long. It is what it is. But there's very, you know, I don't have those moments of sheer surprise. I was so proud of SCI. I was so happy with night two. We kept Alex Zane a surprise. It was not something that was booked for too long, because once Mike Quackenbush fell through because of his concussions, and he wasn't going to be up to to doing the show, we wanted to have a make good. I was really kind of insistent, like, look, we don't need to have something that's equal to Quack, because that's going to be difficult, but I want to have something where fans don't know, but they're like, okay, we didn't, because we know that people were moved to, you know, by the idea of a Mike Quackenbush match at SCI. Who would he work? What would he do? You know, there was a lot of speculation about different opponents. And when that fell through, it was like, well, I don't want to just leave with nothing. I don't want to just, you know. And I met Alex Zane at Pizza Party Wrestling, which, of course, you were at WrestleMania weekend. And we hit it off, and we stayed in touch a little bit. And I broached the idea to him, and we were able to get him in. I said, don't say anything. You know, don't acknowledge it, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, from my understanding is nobody had any clue that Alex Zane was going to come there, be there night two until he walked out the curtain.
No, I didn't have a clue. Not the foggiest.
And that's fantastic, because we wanted it to be like something people would be surprised at, you know, and be like, holy crap, because we want to, you know, my philosophy is to under promise and over deliver. That's what we want to do.
How do you think SCI did this year? What was your overall impressions?
How do you mean? Like, just in what aspect?
Were you just generally, like, Pete and I went over it in explicit detail, but just were you overall proud of the shows? I mean, do you look back and say we did a damn good job?
I think we did a very damn good job, because we did have some complications, like finding out about Quackenbush, because we had him booked. My Thursday at Crux Wrestling was supposed to be watching wrestling, but half an hour in, I get an email saying, because I handled the booking, because I don't live in Chattanooga, I can't do posters. I can't do the local advertising. Scott does a great job with that, and Dylan does that as well. So I try to do some of the stuff I can do remotely. Like, I handled travel arrangements for several of the guys flying in. I handle the online ticket sales, because these are things that I can easily do sitting at a desk. But I got an email. It said the Seattle to Charlotte flight was canceled. And they rebooked Daniel McCabe on a flight that landed 12 hours later, which was at 11:24 or so p.m., which was definitely not going to work because Night Wooden would have been over. So I was able to get on the phone with Travelocity and go back and forth. And I was on the phone for, you know, I'd already been dealing with this a bunch, trying to figure out what I could do. And then I was on the phone with them for 62 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I was on the phone with them for 62 minutes trying to figure out an alternate to get Dan in. And we were able to switch him to a different city. But even so, when you switch to a different city, we had to figure out how to get him from Atlanta to Chattanooga. And we got him a shuttle. But it's like, okay, you know, is that going to get him here in time? It's a Friday leaving Atlanta. A Friday afternoon leaving Atlanta.
Oh, I heard about it. I was terrified.
Yeah, and thankfully his flight was early, and as soon as he landed, we communicated. He was able to get on a shuttle that was an hour early. They let him. We arranged that if he was able to get there before it took off, and there was a seat, he could get on it. So he got on the 4:15 instead of 5:15. But you know, he didn't arrive in Chattanooga in time to get any in-ring time, you know, before the show. So, you know,
still put on some bangers.
So Tony Deppen didn't arrive. He landed in Chattanooga because he was also flying through Charlotte. Same weather issues. He didn't arrive till like 3:30 a.m. Thankfully, the Chattanooga airport, as you well know, is extremely close.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he arrived at like 3:30 a.m. You know, because he also came through Charlotte, and that was a pain in the neck. So. All of these things aside, you know, I know Dylan at one point said everything that could go wrong did, but creatively, I feel like we did very well. I feel like, you know, there are multiple people who could have won SEI, and there are multiple people who could have won futures, and I think the two choices that we had, I think the two winners were about as good selections as we could possibly have.
I definitely agree. I think you picked the right winners there.
You know, I think there would have been choices that could have been made that weren't wrong, but I think we definitely made I think the right guys won, and that's not any sort of slam on anybody else. It's just, you know, because that is those are the directions that we went, and then we had to figure out how to deal with Dan's ear injury. You know, that was a very big deal, because he had his ear injury and he was going to win, and the funny part is we'd already used a scramble winner, so we didn't have that in our back pocket. If Dan legitimately couldn't go and his ear couldn't be patched up where it would be safe, because I don't know if you saw, but his ear was very ugly.
Oh, I saw it. I was yeah, it was right in front of me and it was disgusting.
Yeah,
it was absolutely gory.
Yeah, and but I feel creatively they went extremely well. You always want to sell more tickets. You always want to have more people there, but that's unless you sell out. That's exactly the same thing you're going to say about every single wrestling show ever. So, you know, I wish we had sold more tickets. I think Scott Hensley did a great job locally, and Dylan. We have our partners, as you talked about, with TWE in Chattanooga. Promoting the shows and letting us sell tickets and push the shows, but I feel like creatively we did extremely well.
I think we did really well as well.
I'm very pleased, and I don't often say that about even my own shows.
Speaking of your own shows,
yeah,
you have something coming up this Friday.
I do.
Let's talk about what you have. Squats the match. The battle of who could bench more, basically, which I'm looking forward to so very much. and you just have a hell of a card. Let's talk about this week's action show before we wrap up.
Yeah, it's Friday. When this comes out, it'll be this Friday night, August 16th. All our past arc content, of course, is available on Independent Wrestling TV. Promo code ACTION gets you 20 free days. Got to get that plug in. And you can also follow us on Twitter at WrestleAction and the number one. And on Facebook and Instagram, we are Action Wrestling and the number one. But August 16th, we got... I'm very lucky. I feel like with the talent that I get, I could almost just pick names out of a hat and it would end up being a great show if I ever decided to go that way. I feel like it's going to be awesome. Slim J and AC Mack are facing off for the Action Championship. In a funny note, both of them lost to Daniel Maccabi on night two, the eventual winner on Obscene City, which was of course not planned and not something that we could have foreseen, but that's interesting. We have Eric Stevens versus Fred Yehi in a unique match. That's a first time match.
Eric Stevens' comeback tour has been amazing, by the way.
Yeah, we started talking and I knew that this was going to be a unique thing. His heyday wasn't when I was watching wrestling so much and not paying attention to a lot of shows, but I also recognized that it was going to be a good opportunity. I know his talent, and there were certain guys that he wanted to work, and it's so funny because he put a list out of like 7 or 8 guys that he wanted to wrestle, and 3 or 4 of them had appeared on action shows before. And probably the guy I would have picked in any case would have been Fred Yehi. So Eric Stevens versus Fred Yehi is, I think that's going to be a very, very good match. I'm excited. Oh my God. I mean, Fred's run in action has been, it really has been a fantastic run. He's wrestled Kane Justice twice. They were both really good matches. He had a 3-match series with Eric Royal that was just outstanding.
Maybe the highlight of the promotion, honestly, yeah.
It's so underrated because, and I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because Eric Royal's a North Carolina guy and his only exposure is in Georgia, so is with Action, so he's not a guy who's as well-known. But it's funny because Larry Goodman says that the Eric Royal-Fred Yehi matches were his favorite matches. That I've had and some of his favorite matches of the last year, and he didn't attend any of them live. he missed all 3 shows. So if I ever want Larry to skip a show, I just need to book Fred and Eric together. We've also got Liam Gray debuting from Evolve. He's one of the Skulk members.
Real talented.
Very funny. Legitimately funny guy, a good dude to talk to, and he's going to be wrestling Bobby Flacco. Flacco's interesting. He's a character and a personality that people are attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of people who are just naturally drawn to him, and I have a lot of neighbors and friends who go to shows. My neighbor brought their grandkids. It was their first show last time, and who was her favorite wrestler? It was Bobby Flacco. Yeah, and it's just he's got something, from a personality charisma standpoint that is absolutely there and on point, and it's natural. It's not a put on. He's generally genuinely a good dude, and unfortunately at Futures he went in with a bad shoulder. So sure. I know he was disappointed in how he did, but he was in a lot of pain. He was in a lot of pain, but he wanted to make sure that he did the show. And he's, at the Rumble, he and Sonico had a hell of a 6-minute match.
I love that match.
That was a way to start off the show big time for the 2019 Rumble. And Flacco had a hell of a match with AR Fox on my April show in action.
Mm-hmm.
He's wrestled Slim J, so he's definitely somebody who's been tested. So he and Liam Gray are going to have a great match. I've got James Bandy and Alan Angels, who last show actually ended up having a double turn. James Bandy turned heel and Alan Angels turned babyface. That was probably something creatively that I was very difficult to pull off, and I feel like it landed about as well as could hope. Because doing a double turn, to a live crowd without a commentator to explain it. It was, I was very happy with all the guys who executed it.
Yeah, I think they pulled it off well. Yeah.
There was a lot of moving pieces in that. We've also got, this is that, well, Gorilla, they're going to have to reinforce the ring. We've also got the 2019 Action Wrestling Scenic City Futures Showcase Tournament winner, Steve Manders, the Iowa Hawkeye versus AJ Gray.
Squats the match.
I mean, Steve Manders is everything that we thought another football player turned wrestler was going to be, and so much more. And
I ain't touching that one.
I'm not either. I'm just making an observation. Apparently, you're allowed to do that. You know, Steve's a good guy too. We've mm-hmm. talked for months, and he's so hungry and wants to get it, and he deserves all the success that has been coming to him. His road schedule, his Road Warrior schedule, is insane. He's leaving my show to go. He's not even. He can't even wrestle Saturday. His drive is going to be so long to make a Sunday shot. He can't. He didn't even book anything for Saturday. So he's like, man. Yeah, he's in that AJ Gray's done a lot of that too. So which is mm-hmm. interesting. Most notably, the last few years, the guy who made it the most doing these type of insane drives was Curt Stallion. You know, Curt Stallion was making, an 8-hour drive, you know, one way for Curt Stallion was short.
Stallion would leave Texas and just, like, drive to New York for nothing, basically. Yeah, I talked to Stallion about this. He was a complete psychopath.
Curt Stallion, a few years ago, drove from, like, I think it was in St. Louis at the time. He drove to Tennessee to meet the Carneys, drove with them to Florida. They did a Friday. Saturday, they drove up to New York and then worked. And did a Sunday, and then drove back. And Curt Stallion went and did that with him there's reasons why guys like Curt Stallion are successful. Yes, he's extremely talented. Yes, he works hard. But there's other reasons, and it involves getting out of your comfort zone and making sure you meet people and make towns. And that's how it can happen. I do have a couple other matches to announce as well that I haven't yet.
Okay.
So, for August 16th. But I'm psyched about that. We are doing something a little bit different with our filming, and we anticipate hopefully having it up on Independent Wrestling TV as early as Saturday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Fantastic. So if you're not there in Tyrone, Georgia, you should be. I'm driving 3.5 hours, so you should too. Catch it on Independent Wrestling TV.
Yeah, I'm very psyched about the show. I'm excited. We're already planning on our poster design for October 25th. There's going to be some new names for our December 6th show. There's going to be some new names. Guys who come in, even if it's just for a match or two, I want to get the best in independent wrestling I can. I want Action to be the destination where wrestlers from outside the state want to land. They'd come in because they see Action as a conduit to bigger things.
Well, Matt, you are a friend. You are a hell of a promoter. You have a fascinating story, and I love you to death. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm glad we finally could.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I will see you on Friday, my friend.
Man, I can't wait. I'm excited, and maybe I'll have more than 30 seconds at a time to chat with you.
Seriously. All right, dude. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.